The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Nadine Bakshov is a member of the Museum of Thought Collective, an imaginal archaeology group specializing in unearthing historical conceptual artifacts, and he founded a radical post-conceptual art movement with the Argentine pataphysician Kurt Caesar. His book, Against Capitalist Education, is out from Zero Books right now. The book was written as a philosophical dialogue and argues that the education system is being crushed by the demands of capitalism and, in turn, is crushing those who pass through it. Friedrich Faust, author of Gone with the Crowd, blurbed the book this way: a fundamental challenge to those who argue the humanities have no place in the brave new world dominated by the technocrats. It's Christmas Eve, 2015. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books. In this episode, you'll hear a bit of music from a little movie called Star Wars, an excerpt from a YouTube video featuring Dr. Bart van Heerkenhuizen, forgive me if I mispronounce that, from the University of Amsterdam, as he explains the ideas of Emil Durkheim, as well as some clips about Jediism. The music you're listening to now is from the awesome 8-Bit, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Nadim Bakshov and I discuss his book, Against Capitalist Education.
For about 30 years, I started my undergraduate life as an astrophysics student, and I remember the walk back from the physics class back to my student hall just along the way. It was in Bloomsbury. I was at UCL. It was just across the road. And my family is very messy. I've got a large family. We come from, you know, we have all kinds of different issues, identity issues. This is why Islam's in the mixture and all kinds of stuff. Very messy household with all kinds of culture clashes and issues, none of which has a nice formula or a nice way of kind of dealing with and sorting out. And there I was in this lecture, and as I was walking back, I'd find myself saying, how come we don't really have a mathematics as pristine and as useful that you could apply to human life? And I thought, that's just a ridiculous idea, because what would it be, a formula? There was a text by Ted Hondrick, who was the professor of philosophy at UCL at the time, and someone wrote an equation for what love was, which I thought the most ridiculous thing in the world. So I thought, that can't be what I mean. But then at the same time, I went through a massive series of crises of thinking, well, physics seems more or less it's nailed itself to it, and actually it seems quite empty in many ways. It seems like it draws these really fantastic crystalline structures and then extrapolates them. And, you know, we know Stephen Hawking and people like that are very, very popular. I have met him at his book launch when his first book came out, and that was quite an interesting experience. I just thought it all seemed very empty, that we have done fantastic things the last 200-300 years with maths of the natural world, but the human being and human society, human social life, psychology, all the rest of it seems incredibly messy. So I thought to myself, you know, being a massive, massive fan and Star Trek, you know, and you're a fan of Star Trek, as I am as well. But I mean it almost like that, because philosophy can do that to you. And I love Descartes. I love Descartes, not because of his formulations. I think they were completely wrong. But I love him for his sitting down in that room and writing that book and saying, you know, let's just doubt everything and let's just start. So I thought, could I devote my life to doing a similar gesture. You know, then I didn't have, I was on my own single, obviously young undergraduate. And I knew that I was good at a range of different subjects and unusually good at humanities and loved the humanities as much as the sciences and maths. And I thought, could I do something now and see where it led me? And I thought, I'm just going to go for it. So I didn't follow the normal course of events, which would be to go and do doctorate research and continue. UCL had some good connections with CERN. I didn't want to do any of that. I just literally went and worked in an esoteric bookshop. And then I worked here, J jobs here, taught abroad, did all kinds of stuff. So I was completely isolated. I could start developing this idea and out of this crisis to see whether, and I suppose to some extent, I manufactured a crisis because I really wanted to say, if you have one life, what would you try to do with your one life? If you knew you had some ability and talent, what would you do with it that could give something back to the world?
I'm hearing in your retelling of how you came to write this book, a bit of the split that I saw at the beginning of Against Capitalist Education, the split between the kind of arid, abstract realm of pure mathematical reason.
Yes.
And yeah, the more fleshed out, sensuous realm of the literary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's not very popular now, but Richard Rorty, I liked him. I went through an infatuation with Richard Rorty, not in the flesh, but in his writing. For a little while, because he seemed to me completely deflationary. He just wanted to knock philosophy off its pedestal and see what would be left and what would be of any use. He kind of went off in quite boring politics, I think. He had, I don't know why I just mentioned him. I suppose I was thinking about, right at the end of Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, he talks about two types of conversations. And one of them is he calls an epistemological one, where you basically agree the terms of your conversation. And so you can look around and see all kinds of examples of that. But in the other one, he called a hermeneutic one, which was you cannot even agree on your basic terms. And I thought, what's the problem with the world? What's the fundamental problem? And especially when you bring religion into it as well, and politics and how to change it, it's what is that vocabulary that everyone will say, yeah, look, let's agree with that. And then let's just mark out a territory and disagree over, you know, certain aspects of it. We seem to be in the world now and on so many different levels, hideously, incredibly fractured as a species, on from religion to secularism versus atheism versus left versus right. I mean, America seems more polarized than in Europe, but that's changing in Europe. It seems to be getting more and more polarized as well. It seems almost impossible to find that common ground. And then if you bring in religion, I mean, I used to read the Quran with my mum when up to the age of 14. And then suddenly I said to her, Mum, you know, I don't even understand, because I don't know if you know, in Islam, one of the things you do in Islam is you carry out practices. As a non-Arabic speaker, you would read the Quran and you wouldn't necessarily understand the language or what it meant. And so I turned around and said to her, Mum, you know, I don't really know what I'm reading. I can hear the poetry and the language of it. I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to stop. I'm going to go away and try to work out, you know, what I think about various things, and maybe I'll come back to it. I've never quite come back to it, not in that orthodox kind of ordinary type of way. But because the big pressing question is, well, we know we got, you know, terrorism. In one of your early podcasts, you discussed, should the left, one of the questions you had with Ashley was, should the left align itself with, you know, radical Islam? And it made me think again, common ground. What is the common ground? So the premise of the book is actually quite simple. If I were to teach this new type of mathematics that I've created over 30 years, what kind of education would you need in order to grasp it? That was, if you like, the burning question. So many people said to me, Nad, how are you going to get the rest of the world? Because if you go to a maths department, they'll say, this is just, it's just some kind of abstract art, ultra-conceptual art. It doesn't really, it's got a grammar, it's got various different properties that we recognize loosely. It's, you know, it's a symbolic notation and all the rest of it, but we can't recognize it. I get the most patronizing responses from academic philosophers, ironically, who say you can't invent anything new. I had one very recently from a university very close to me, and the guy said to me, well, I'm very pleased that you're very humble about what you've created, because let's face it, why do we need a new notation? You know, you're just wasting your time. And I thought,
no.
It was after an introductory thing where I said, I could be wasting my time, but I've spent 30 years. Can I come and chat to you about it? So on that side, the traditional mathematical side, it's not an obvious place to be. It has in some ways, ironically, a closer home with the arts and the humanities, but a typical humanities student tends to hate abstract notation and mathematics. That's why I like Lacan, because he tried in some way to bridge the two in some kind of way. Why I think Bourdieu didn't quite work for me, because Bourdieu's too conservative, ironically. Although he's very left-wing in his politics, his mathematical thought is very conservative for me. He needs to have invented a new mathematics. I mean, he's a talented mathematician. And he could have just sat down and said, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to get all my students to try to invent new types of mathematics, new symbolic notations, and see where they lead. And if any of them's any good, one of them's any good, it could be what we want. It could really help. So what kind of education would you need if you were to learn this type of thought? Because it is essentially a new type of thinking. And I thought, oh my goodness, it's even worse than that. I couldn't even put a syllabus together, because I would struggle to find a university that would say, what economic benefit is there going to be if they learn your thing? You're just elevated navel gazing, haven't you? And I say, no, hang on, we've got a responsibility with politics. We've got a responsibility. There are kind of hidden assumptions. You can be an engineer on one side and you can go out and you can make bridges. But on the humanities side, no, you can analyze political systems. You may join the political class. You may take on a political position. But politics and social sciences have a completely different tenor. I'm not convinced they do. And I think a solution to what I think is the blockage that Heidegger created, he sort of dammed up philosophy for me in many ways, the way out, the way forward, because his Nazi affiliations, which show the poverty of some aspects of his thought, is that we need not just one, but a billion new attempts, almost like a whole new movement of new art forms.
Well, okay, I want to go back to Rorty for a moment. You mentioned that he said there were two kinds of conversations that people can have, the hermeneutic and the epistemological approach. Now, let me see if I've got this right. It seems to me that the hermeneutic is the realm of more struggle, because you're trying to set up terms. And that seems very difficult to me, because it seems like without terms, there wouldn't be even a basis for struggle, that you wouldn't have anything like a conversation if you didn't have some sort of agreed upon framework that you were operating in. Yeah, does the hermeneutic, this kind of pure struggle over terms, exist, is my first question. And then, do you think that the problem with the epistemological realm is that the frameworks that are adopted are not justified, and that the problem with the hermeneutic realm, where you're struggling over setting up terms, is that the frameworks aren't recognized?
That's a really nice way of characterizing it. I like the use of the justification. I thought you were going to say that the hermeneutic was seeking justification for the epistemological. A good example, I think, of hermeneutic discussion would be religion and atheism. Science, creationism versus evolutionism would probably be a classic, obvious one out there. You know, Richard Dawkins, I've watched him for hours and hours, some of which I find interesting. I've watched Sam Harris for hours and hours, listen to what he has to say. And it seems to me that the best way of understanding is that I agree at one level. You're absolutely right. They're both using the word Islam, for example, when we talk about Sam Harris. He's using the word Islam, he's using the word religion with a capital R, which is always problematic. But if you push that forward, that term is almost like an umbrella term. And if you unpick it and you hear what he's actually saying, he's talking about something very different to someone who might be someone who's operating within a typical religious or a theological framework. And it's almost as if I were to use a kind of image of a vector. One person is looking in one direction and the other is looking in another, and they're almost talking at an angle to each other. So it looks like they're having a conversation. But part of the problem, I think, part of the conflict is that their basic terms, the way they're operating on those basic terms, just don't connect. If they stopped using capital letters religion, capital letters science, we may get somewhere. And that's where I think it becomes more productive in some kind of way. So I think I see that as a classic mainstream issue. And we know with the Paris situation that this issue about terrorism, what does it mean? How does it represent? What does it represent about Islam? Again, Islam with a capital I, and all the debates about, you know, what is terrorism versus with a capital T and versus state and all this kind of stuff. Again, those conversations are probably the most hermeneutic because they all sound like they're talking to each other. But when you listen, and I almost spend a year listening to a conversation, I'll listen to it again and again, or I'll read a passage again and again and try to unpick it. And it just strikes me that they're using the words in actually very different ways, which brings me to Wittgenstein. That the words don't refer, the reason I think the hermeneutic thing means something is the words don't refer to a reality you can point to. This is also why Rorty was a fan of Derrida. Don't point to reality out there which is somehow agreed and defined, but is partly on its way to constituting something of that reality. And it's not just we've got different lenses on looking at the same thing. It's almost like two different pictures, two different sides of this, of an object. And do you know the classic story about the four blind men and the elephant? Yeah, it's almost like that. One person thinks he's got a tree because he's holding the leg. One person thinks he's got something else because he's holding the... And yet there's an elephant there. And it's some... And the work, I thought, what was missing in all of that type of thing... And that's an interesting Sufi parable, which comes out of Islam, interestingly enough. And it's interesting that Zizek uses another classic one, which also has its origins in Islamic culture. So for those who might think that Islam is just a... I watched a video of someone saying that everyone's a terrorist who's a Muslim, and I thought, okay, maybe not. So that's my point. What is that thing in the middle? So then I ask myself, what discourse do we have out there? This is the argument that Badiou uses. What conversation do we have out there that everyone would agree is universal... Right. It's universal. And we all think that this is the contentious point. He says it's just mathematics. I take a slightly different approach to mathematics, but I agree with him partially. Mathematics for me is part of language. It grows out of language. And I would defy any mathematician to try to do mathematics without language, metaphor, conversation, etc. You stripped all that stuff out. You could probably manipulate symbols, but you cannot. It makes no sense. It is just manipulation of symbols. And computers do that better than we do. And we know that has no real meaning at all. So he thinks mathematics is the universal language. I don't know why Zizek thinks he's the new Hegel, because I think that thought is deeply flawed. Mathematics, the power of mathematics is that it breaks, it doesn't allow you to get caught in interpretation as much. You can manipulate symbols and you've done a big chunk of the work and you can spend some time interpreting it. Whereas in the on the human sciences, the interpretation plays a really critical role in the way that you're going to converse and exchange and move something forward. If you're going to develop a new society, how could you develop a new society unless you talk about the different perspectives? So I put myself right in that awkward space and I said, I want to create an education system that isn't just free of what I call economic fundamentalism, which is obviously the point of view that education systems need to be subservient to the economy. Economy is where everything happens. It dictates the terms of what we do in our schools, our universities. I know this is almost a rehearsal of Althusser's ideological state apparatus type concept. But the reason that I take it forward a little bit is I don't believe in freedom for its own sake, I suppose. I don't think I, unlike Schelling, that or that we're scared of freedom. I think we need to do something with freedom. And I think what you do in freedom, typically, the easiest answer is to look at our arts, is to look at our literature, is to look at our fiction. And that is, for me, a real clue as to what we do with freedom as a species. We imagine things constantly for entertainment, also for alternatives. We create things constantly.
Religious objects are so impressive for the believer because they appear to emanate a power that, according to Durkheim, cannot be anything else than the power of society. We can observe how such a power is produced during religious meetings. Here people are gathered, they are close to each other, they may dance or sing together, and then all of a sudden something spectacular may happen. They may collectively reach a state of euphoria, a kind of ecstasy or rapture that he calls a state of effervescence collective, collective effervescence. They feel uplifted. And that is the moment when the feeling of social unity is created and reinforced, and it is no accident that this can only happen in a collective ritual that is the outcome of accumulated group energy.
Religion versus math. You were talking about the way atheists debate with creationists or with religious people.
Yeah.
And saying that they didn't share enough of the same conceptions and terms to really be speaking to one another, that they were coming at each other at an angle. And you gave the parable of the elephant. Now, there is this idea that people don't always know what they believe, and they don't always talk about what they are believing in directly. So that, for instance, an argument between an atheist and a born-again Christian may appear to be coming from completely different terrains, but in order for that conversation to happen, there's a shared terrain, and I think it's the economic one, but that they do share. Now, maybe not every aspect of the economic, but to give an example, when people argue online about, say, the Syrian refugee crisis,
okay,
they are arguing about not strictly what policies we should have. Often enough, people don't even know what policies there are in place.
Mm-hmm.
What they're arguing about is what is the, which one of them is more moral in this context, and what values should be put forward as the moral values in this context. But they share, in order to have that conversation, they share that basic context, which is the context of capitalism, say. So I find that it's very difficult to enter into these debates without adopting that framework, and that I don't, and that when I do try to intervene, I often enough end up taking positions that I don't fully have, or saying things that I don't fully mean, because I'm forced into this framework that exists, that supports the debate, even as they seem to be defining their terms totally differently and coming at things in a completely different way as possible. To make it clear, I don't want to touch that same elephant. I want to lead them to a different part of the room. And
right.
So
yeah.
This also goes, I think, a little bit to if you start to talk about the economic realm as the realm that is actually giving us a context for our conversations and arguments between, say, religion and atheism.
Yeah.
What you are doing is stepping away from, I think, this linguistic turn in philosophy. It's not an uncomplicated step away. You're not just going straight into the natural sciences, but you're going into the realm of matter, nonetheless, the material world that is humanly created and distributed.
Okay.
So that's a different kind of materialism, one that is influenced by ideas and is shaped by ideas, but isn't identical to them.
Listening to how you're characterizing it, it's fascinating how you've just characterized it, I have to say, in this respect. When I keep out of a lot of these debates, if I find two people arguing, my younger brother, who also did a philosophy degree, and he's much more political than I am, ever have been, he'll launch at people very aggressively about their politics. And it's almost as if your characterization is right. They're arguing, and it's almost like a game. It's almost like they do actually share their terms, which is, I think, the implicit part of the implicit point you're making. They share terms, they're in a kind of slight state of denial that one, you know, and they're implicitly agreeing a scale, my scale is bigger than yours, and my morality is better because I do this. I get that. What would I say? It's difficult to comment, I suppose, if we take something like Syria, because in the UK at the moment, they're debating endlessly, and I find the politics that we have so depressing. And my spirit has not been lifted given the fact that even someone you would hope has a completely different agenda has moved into mainstream politics, because I think the machine is just too big for someone like Jeremy Corbyn and all the mess. I think Elliot Murphy, who also wrote Zero Books on the website, on Facebook, mentioned, you know, his disappointment about it. I find myself, Dawkins is my favourite example. He hates philosophers. He hates fundamental religion people, and yet he kind of is completely and utterly clueless about the way that he uses language. And yet he sets up oppositions in places that are straw men for a start. I have a problem with certain types of linguistic conflict, because if what you're saying is that there's not really a genuine conflict there, they essentially agree, but what they're trying to do, because they agree there's an economic framework, money, finance, the flow of capital, workers, the impact on our local economy, having all these refugees come pouring in, and stuff like this. I agree with that, but It's that Rortian idea, and I don't agree with his politics. And I found very offensive when I first read it, that people are naturally, what did he call it? Ethno something or other, ethnocentric, that they think more about their local population where we're together. So it's racial stereotypes. Muslims are brown, therefore they're, you know, dangerous to us. But the us-them split. And it's, you know, when we're talking about hermeneutic conversation where two people are trying to talk across a split, mm-hmm. You're right. On one level, they are talking to each other. They're exchanging words. Economically, they might be in a workplace. So they might actually have a subordinate and a, you know, seniority relationship. But there is a split in what goes on between the two people that I don't think I have seen a really adequate analysis of. I'll see if I can articulate it. I spent a long time trying to get this thing right. Two people can be sitting and having a conversation. Samuel Beckett, I think, comes quite close to this. So if you watch one of his plays, you see two characters. Waiting for Godot has some fantastic moments in there. And you sit there and you think, what are they actually talking about? And did the other person actually respond to him? Yes, he did, but no, he didn't. How can you have this dual layer where they seem to be talking to each other? So they're, you know, the old guy is sitting around waiting. One's going on about his shoes and the other starts referring to something in the past. And they're having an exchange. Oh, I've got a bit of a footache. And the other person says that. But there's something that's also at the same time, simultaneously, they are not talking to each other. And if I were to characterize more precisely what I understand Rorty to be saying and sort of accept your criticism that people do talk to each other, I would say it's this dual nation. You know, in physics, okay, I can give another metaphor. If you take a lens and you shine a bright light through it and it'll bend the light, you know, and you pass light in through a glass of water, it'll bend the light. That gives you a very good, I think, a simple metaphor for the type of thing I mean. Conversation gets refracted from the point someone utters something and the point they receive it. But not everything is lost in this transmission between two people. So, yes, you're right. Hermeneutic, they do. Something has been transmitted. But the refraction in meaning passing between one person uttering it and the other person receiving it, something critically can get lost. And that's how I characterize a lot of these kind of science versus evolution debates, these mainstream, really, really, they wind people up. They get really, really het up. It's almost as if invisibly there's a shadow in the communication. Is that making any sense at all?
In Waiting for Godot,
yeah,
they're not talking to each other, but they are both addressing a third presence.
Yes.
And they are influenced by the other's comments And they react to those comments, but always directing it to the third, or often, not always, but often.
Yeah, yeah.
So, for instance, I pulled up Godot there. So he says, Estragon says, "No one ever suffers but you. I don't count. I'd like to hear what you'd say if you had what I have." Estragon says, "It hurts." And Vladimir says, so actually it's Vladimir then Estragon. Estragon says, "It hurts." And Vladimir says, "Hurts. He wants to know if it hurts." Now, who is he talking to? Right? Yeah. And Estragon says, "You might button it all the same." So I guess he's walking around with his penis hanging out. So,
or not in the production, like, I've seen.
Right, no. But the point here is that I think that there is, even when we're talking past each other, we're talking past each other in a context where there's a third presence. And another kind of anecdotal example of this is my daughter recently had an argument with one of her friends at school, in high school. And it had to do with her friend hadn't answered my daughter's texts and was ignoring her. And there's lots of background to that. And there was reasons why she was ignoring her. But the point was, she said something like, she's acting as though I'm being irrational, getting upset about a few texts, and people will think, you know, based on just a little context, that, you know, I'm the one who's being paranoid. But she knows that, in fact, we used to talk every day, and now she's not responding to me over many days. And I said, well, who is this person that's going to be judging your texts and this conversation other than her, who knows this?
Right.
I mean, who are you talking about? And she's that didn't really go anywhere, but it did exist. I mean, they were both, when they were arguing, to make a case to a hypothetical person who wasn't there. You know,
that is really, really fascinating. I have a daughter, and she goes through similar things as well. You make me think of Lacan. There's something he says that's quite interesting here. In one of his early papers, he wrote the structure of the self is a paranoid structure. And I spent a long time thinking about it, and I thought it's paranoia is where you feel constantly the presence, self-consciously the presence of someone else, but there's no one there. So those who, you know, will take certain biochemical, you know, materials will tell you that paranoia can be heightened and it can get so irrational. And it's almost as if what Lacan recognized was this presence, this third presence. There's a line in T.S. Eliot, it's something to do with a presence, and there's a line where he talks about, is it Scott of the Antarctic, and there was a third. I've got to remember where that quote came from, but it echoes that in my mind. But if our consciousness is paranoid, it senses the presence, as you put it, the presence, a third presence of something. So Beckett, you could argue superficially, there's the audience, right? But he doesn't mean the audience, because that's too easy. It collapses. And yet it does mean the audience, because when he wrote it, partly, it wasn't just a group of people. Now, this is the move that you might find really bizarre. I would argue that this is a fundamental, it's Derrida's absence that you're talking about in my mind, the sense that there was something occupied a role within my life and it's gone, but I can't tell when it occupied it. Having, you know, effectively being lapsed in my own kind of religious background, I find myself constantly in a conversation with this third unknown person. And I wonder if it's just for people who've come with a religious background or everyone does it. And when I read Lacan and I thought, you know, he comes from a Catholic background, so maybe religion either causes this type of thing by, you know, God suddenly disappears and no longer can play that role. You know, your opening of your podcast with the death of God, that's a great opening. Okay, so this absence, this metaphysical, one move I would make here is that, I don't know, you like science, I know you like science fiction, but do you like horror fiction?
I do. I'm not as, I don't write horror fiction as traditionally, but like Lovecraft might be a good example of having a...
Lovecraft's a fantastic example of it. When I was in San Francisco some years ago, I did the one thing I never do, which is go to the cinema on my own. I feel always odd when I do it. because my wife was here and I was on a work-related thing. So I was there and I went and saw Evil Dead. And I don't know if you know the history of Evil Dead. They've got a great TV franchise, Evil Dead versus Ash. Very comic horror, but it's supernatural. I mean, essentially, these monsters are supernatural and they feed out of Lovecraftian mythology. I had a really strange thought that, you know, we're talking about absences in a theological, metaphysical context. And you read, you know, if you come from a traditional philosophical background, you're going to get very serious, put a very posh English accent on, which I don't have, and say, yes, of course, metaphysics, book three, blah, blah, blah. And on you go about Aristotle. But actually, the supernatural is almost like the metaphysical in slightly different garb. I watched Evil Dead and I thought to myself, we've banished God, but we haven't banished the supernatural. And it's crept into popular culture so dramatically through vampirism, zombies. They try to materialize them, but it doesn't work. The Force and, you know, Star Wars is absolute classic for that. But they try to turn it into midichlorides and some kind of biochemical atom nonsense. Right. But anyway, that's rubbish. We know that was. But the supernatural. But here's the thing. In Evil Dead, the supernatural presence is a malevolent force issuing from nature. So, you know, as I do, that Zizek has said nature isn't some lovely, you know, garden of paradise. It's a nasty thing out there. And he's gone on about that. But it's a similar point to that. But the thing I find most fascinating is that this absence that we sense when we think of this third presence has become a malevolent sense. So our paranoia, if we were to take this absence of God, suddenly, well, the devil hasn't gone. And what has the devil, what is this absence transmuted into? It's not that in the absence of God, everything is permitted as we know. It's almost as if it shifted territory and snuck behind nature and turned into this supernatural malevolent force. Supernatural fiction in popular culture is massive. It's gone mainstream big time. You know, people who hate horror, you know, when I was a young boy, Damien, Omen was all very popular. Exorcist was really, really popular. My brother incidentally brought that back when I was a young boy, brought it back and said to my mum, Mum, I've got a religious film. And she thought it was a religious film. So I find that really fascinating. And there's a line in Heidegger. He talks about being, it's one of his latest shorter books where he starts going on about not, the not, notly not of the not. And it's very poorly translated. But you either think this is garbage. You have to read, go back to Hegel, really, to find another example of what he might be trying to get at. But I'm struck by, in this mathematical work that I've done, that if we try to ban it, if we try to, how can I put it? How do you symbolize an absence? You know, I mean, Derrida wrote a letter, he'd put a line through it. I thought that was inadequate because you've written a symbol and then you've scrubbed the symbol out. So I had to, this will give you an insight into what this mathematics does. At the root of this mathematics, the whole mathematics is built on an absence. There is no symbol at the root. So where God previously existed and would have occupied that place. So let's say at the root, if you see the universe as the Norse mythology does, as a big tree and God stands at the root, or as Eckhart does, you know, the Godhead and all this kind of, at the root of existence or cosmos is this. But there is just an absence. And how do you symbolize an absence? And the very act, so, you know, you can have fantastic works of art. I went to a Turner Prize exhibition where someone symbolized absence by an auditorium filled with just empty chairs, all out as though there was a concert. And it really provokes the thought, you know, what does absence mean? It isn't, it's like the logical not. It's like something which you want to deny. But I don't know if this is a misreading of Hegel coming through Alexander Kojève. But if you try to deny an absence, then you end up attributing to that absence something of significance, and, you know, you build desire out of it in some kind of way because you want something and you're motivated for something in some kind of way. So I had to ask, I had to differentiate between not, a negation, a saying no, a denying of something, versus a genuine absence. And that distinction, if I look at Badiou, even if I look at Zizek, and although I really do, like you, enjoy Zizek and I find him really stimulating, I find that when I try to look at the ontologies that people have written around him, I think there's one by Adrian Johnston, which I tried, I've struggled because I think that distinction, normal language really struggles with that distinction and it gets convoluted and messy. But this symbolism, I mean, here I'm sitting there while I'm talking to it, and on my wall I've got a whiteboard, and I've got it there in front of me. And if you were sitting there, you'd probably get it in a millisecond, because I refuse to put a symbol at this certain point within this structure. And that point within the structure is like the Aleph in Jewish mysticism, the point out of which the whole universe creates, but you cannot put a term to it. You know, I'm giving it words, but if you know... You were talking to someone about radical theology. I would say the most radical theology is negative theology, the idea of apophatic discourse, where you have to undo the words you say when you're trying to say what it is. And that, for me, is quite an exciting thing to do, because that then opens up a space to say, someone who comes to me who's a monotheist, who's a Christian or a Muslim or comes from Judaism, or a Buddhist comes to me, or a Hindu, and says to me, what does your symbolism say to me about how my religion fits together and works? And I say, it doesn't deny your particular fleshing out of this absence and how you put it, but this structure exists prior to it, if that kind of makes sense. And that is, I think, quite an exciting thought.
It's very difficult to, well, the structure, when you say the structure exists prior to it, do you mean that the structure of an absence being necessary for there to be a presence exists prior to any presence? Or do you mean a particular kind of absence that existed prior to a presence?
I could probably answer it if... What about Spinoza? How... Do you like Spinoza?
Sure.
Do you, okay.
I don't think Spinoza ultimately came to the final conclusion, but I do like Spinoza. I read Spinoza after having read The Empiricist. So the way I approached Spinoza was maybe in a peculiarly Cartesian way, but it was through Berkeley. So, Berkeley came along and said, you know, we can't adopt this meta term of matter, that there is no realm outside of experience. There's no negative realm, basically. But of course, he couldn't stick to his guns because he had to posit a different negation, which was God.
Yes.
So Spinoza came along and seemed to be solving that issue by saying, look, what we think of as a split is actually contained in this larger set of the universe. The split between mind and matter is actually all, these are all components of a living, present, pantheistic God.
Yes. I would say after William James, panentheistic, which is a very subtle but very important distinction, because what William James is emphasizing is that the universe isn't flat and that the God isn't in everything. God isn't identical with everything, which is pantheism. God is in everything, panentheism. It's bizarre, but it means that you have a vertical structure to existence.
Well, the problem I had with it was that... That whether or not you had an identical, the problem that Spinoza had, and I don't think he solved adequately, was the problem of contingency versus necessity.
I'd agree with that, and also it's interesting how Hegel lifted off and almost inverted. It's almost as if he took the body of Spinoza, ripped his flesh off, and took the skeletal structure and then worked with that skeletal structure in some kind of way, which is, I think the reason I mentioned Spinoza is because if we're talking about an absence, if we were to imagine that what Spinoza actually created was a huge scaffold, but this scaffold was a metaphysical scaffold, so its feet were in this chaotic, undefinable background. I mean, they talk about dark matter as a background, but let's just say it's a metaphysical background of some kind. It's undefinable. It's there. You can give it a name or not. But he erects this scaffold across the top of it. And this purpose of the scaffold is for the flow, this chaotic flow, which is burbles and bubbles underneath. Very Nietzschean image, and also Heraclitus. It channels its way up through this scaffolding structure till it bursts out at the top, which is the world, the visible world, and constructs and builds it in some kind of way. That's what I mean by structure, more like a scaffold. It's more like a fictional scaffold. If I were to say to you, you know, you posted a really interesting thing about fiction for Zero Books, which was how you can elaborate and you can take an idea and you can, I might be misquoting you in some kind of way, or might be distorting it deliberately in my rather odd way. So I apologize. No. But the idea that fiction, what struck me, echoed back with this idea that fiction can create a scaffolding that if you remove that scaffolding and say, you know, Zizek says it very well, you take away the phantasmatic or the fictional, reality disappears. My take on it is that this scaffold is metaphysical, and there is a definite meaning to the way that things flow and structures out of it. So that's what I mean by structure which allows a movement to pass through it. You take that fiction scaffolding away, the truth of what that you wish to express through your fictional creation, and I include music and art and painting as well as, you know, storytelling, you couldn't have truth. And if truth was anything, it was protean, say, at the root, it's mysterious at the root, it needs this metaphorical fictional structure. So what I've done is I've taken language just three or four steps in a funny direction, with my argument that maths is an outgrowth of language. And with this maths, I've stripped it back to a bunch of symbols and lines, if you like, crudely put, lines and symbols. But what they do is that they don't provide a fixed... It's not like Spinoza's deterministic vision that everything is an attribute or a property of the one God, therefore, you know, contingency, accidents, how can they arise, etc., etc. It doesn't do that. But it works as a structure, like a scaffold, like a skeleton, if you like. I characterize it by saying human nature has a metaphysical skeleton.
Sounds to me like you are looking for the internal, not eternal, but maybe both, the internal structure of human thought in the abstract.
Not just that. It's funny you say that, but this is, I thought at the back of my mind, I'm going off on a typical NAD tangent to everything, so I apologize. I have a habit of doing it. But the social and the political. So if you were to say to me, NAD, that's all very well, your education, fine, they would learn your stuff. The world would stay as it is, we'd have great, this new kind of art, whatever it is. And the world would stay as it is, we'd still all remain capitalists and be stuck where we are. So what benefit does it have for politics and for society and social form? My argument is that this structure, the structure of a thought, is itself intrinsically social. So can I model that really precisely using this type of technical precision, if you like? So I've invented a couple of intermediate terms, and it really does ask the question, begs the question, that if the structure of the mind, an individual mind, your subjectivity, has a social structure, that there is a very, and we know that there's a very complex mapping of individual minds to our social forms. We know that we can have this conversation, and 10 minutes later after the conversation, we'll be talking about, you know, a sofa we need to buy in our living rooms and all this kind of the banal everyday stuff. Sort out, I've got a plan, you know, tomorrow and get the kids food and all this kind of stuff. We know we operate on all these different levels, but I've always felt, Ashley said it very well. She said, when you have a moment of crisis, there is a temptation to avoid this type of thinking. And Zizek says his damning critique of, I find, of Chomsky is that he says, it's not about empirical, it's about thought. It's about really, really thinking. So whether this is a completely lunatic invention, so, you know, Dadaism and surrealism and pataphysics and all these kind of inventions as a kind of space in which something can be invented, which could work. Maybe history will put it in those categories. But at this moment, it strikes me that if I can get it to work, it suggests that a revolution, what we consider to be a revolution in our change, our form of life, our social systems, our economic systems, which are the fundamental problem. They're the fundamental obstacle, the blockage, because our age is an age of worshipping at the altar of money, numbers. And if we can shatter that by providing an alternative model, concept, structure, which is non-numeric. This is my difference with Badiou. Although he says numbers aren't fundamental to reality, I feel, although on his math side, he's very conservative, feeding very conservative notions of how reality is constructed. And I think he's echoing back what I call economic fundamentalism. Basically, the number trumps a person. So it doesn't matter that we put 5,000 people out of work. because numbers in this particular part of the system need to, you know, be allowed to permit to be able to do X, Y, and Z, etc. My challenge to that is that if our fundamental social structures are, A, yes, they're semiotic because they involve sign systems, but money is not the definitive sign. You know, I wonder if you like Star Trek for the same reason I do. When Gene Roddenberry said, really early on, he wanted to imagine a universe where money didn't exist. I remember reading a quote and thinking, really? Did he really want to do that? So I rewatched Star Trek and I thought, actually, there is money. Because when they have the Tribbles, if you remember the episode of the Tribbles, is they're exchanging cash somewhere along the line.
It's Federation credits. He can't. But you know, he can't now. But I mean, it's still money. He can't. He's inconsistent. There are episodes where they claim there's no money, and there's technology where there would seem to be no need for money. The replicator technology makes that possible, but and yet they, whether it's gold plated Latinum or Federation credits, they do good. Money always pops up when needed for a plot.
Being, you know, the Jedi Church leader, then I should, you know, have an explanation of what I believe in. So, to me, yeah, I'd say yes, I do believe in God, but if you believe in a deity, I would say no. And the God that I believe in is...
On this episode, we ask, are you tired of religions that rely on stale old traditions and are full of boring followers who can't read minds, levitate objects, jump super high, or have super cool laser swords?
Now, the Force is what gives the Jedi his power. It's an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together.
My final question is not even about your book, but you said at the beginning of the podcast, and you've brought up this podcast with Ashley a couple of times, and it seems to me you have something on your mind about Islam that hasn't quite been articulated yet, and I want to hear that. So
it's interesting what you said to her and what you were talking about. If I can just try to remind myself of what it was that struck me is that I could have an interesting thought. Maybe I'm just in fantasy land over that as well. So you said something like, could the left, or did she ask it, ally itself with radical Islam versus the Imperium as a way of, you know, challenging the Imperium, or should the left ally itself with the Imperium versus these kind of fringe marginal activities? I think it was something along the lines of that struck me, really interested me. Is that... Kind of vaguely
That's right. That's the question I asked. And I wanted to reject both propositions. Yeah. I certainly don't want to align myself with a radical Islam, and I don't want to align myself. And then radical, I mean, I'm not even sure what the right term is, but that's what I'll say, call it radical Islam.
That's a common term.
Yeah. And then I don't want to align myself with Western imperialism either.
Yes, and you went on to discuss also something about belief, and I think Ashley says something about the importance of it reviving parts of the Enlightenment project, you know, as a way of counterbalancing this kind of threat of irrationality or these totalizing or fascistic kind of...
Yeah, systems. I mean, we both consider ourselves to be Marxists. I call myself a wannabe Marxist, and she... So, because I'm still reading him, you know, and I when I've written... couple
Me
of
too.
Books on Marx. Maybe I'll call myself a Marxist, but I'm still reading him and studying. So, but what, you know, Marx was an Enlightenment philosopher. He was full on into the Enlightenment, and his thought was that, you know, turning the Enlightenment critique against capitalism could lead to a better society. I mean, he doesn't articulate it that way, but that's how I interpret him. You know, you want to the most radical critique you can get.
Okay, so if we say that and we go back to the Enlightenment project, I'm a child of the Enlightenment, although my parents come from ostensibly a Muslim culture. But my take on it is slightly odd and different, I suppose. I had a student, a math student, many, many years ago, who went on and many years later, after I disconnect, to my shock, to go and join ISIS. And I've traced back, it traumatized me quite a lot because I thought to myself, You know, I take a very strong view about the value of religion in the right context, but I have a very poor view of religion as a literal fundamentalist type of function. And I remember having conversations with him about what Islam was. So my question to him was, what is Islam? And he couldn't tell me. He had some vague idea that things were wrong and this and that and the other. So I said to him, OK, let me tell you what Islam is. So I handed him a book of Sufism, the kind of spiritual, the Jalaluddin Rumi, Ibn al-Arabi, all these types of writers. And I said, if you want to know what your religion is, then read them, because they will take you to some place within the religion which will make you understand what religion really ought to be doing for you, and why we, you know, we, this massive system that we erect around it.
You offered him mysticism, basically.
I offered him.
Well, I mean, yeah. These were Sufi mystics, right?
And you know what really depressed me? I thought maybe that drove him off the edge. Because, and I said this to my wife. I said, oh, God, you know, I spent hours talking to him, saying to him, that's not what Islam isn't. Islam isn't some kind of codified bunch of thou shalt and thou shalt not type of Old Testament garbage. If you do religion with that, because I think fundamentalism is a poison which affects every religion at the moment, even Buddhism, which I have an enormous amount of respect for. You listen to the stories of them barbarically torturing Hindus and Muslims in different parts of the world. You think they're all doing it. What's wrong with it? Why have we become fundamentalist? And somewhere in the book, I argue that what we've done is there's a very good image of, I don't know if your background is Christianity or are you an atheist, or do you have any kind of Christian background?
I'm very confused. I was brought up Unitarian. Do you know what that is?
Yes, I think I do. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So
that's an interesting.
Are we atheists? Are we theists? I don't know, but where's the seminar? Because we'd love those, but I can't tell you what we believe.
Yeah. But
the book on my shelf that was a religious book was something about the benefits of a liberal theology. So
okay, all right, okay, yeah. There's been a massive movement in that area, but the image I have is again another mystical one. There was a French writer called René Guénon who revived a tradition which was a comparative religion one, and he used the symbol of the cross. He wrote a book, and he wrote this not for Christians but for any religious background. He said the cross symbolizes an image, a metaphor of the structure, the ontological structure of existence. The vertical represents the connection deep downward and into the roots of reality, which enter this space of the mystical ground, etc., etc., and it intercepts at the point the horizontal intercepts. The horizontal represents the historical passage of time, and the current moment when we're in is the point of intersection. And I don't know why I've just mentioned that, but I tried to talk to him about the fact that if you really want to, because I wanted him to become a maths teacher, I thought what a great vocation that would be. It is a fun subject, even you know, unless you're really crazy. Your son would agree, I'm sure.
Yeah,
it is when you do. When I listened to what you two said, I thought to myself, there's something desperately wrong with parts of the... How can I put it? I'm reading a book called Refuting ISIS, written by one of the top 50 clerics within one of the four schools of Islam. Now, normally, I don't read anything on that kind of territory, but I thought I'm compelled to, because I want to know, how is the religion relating back to this kind of outgrowth, which seems to be parasitic on its core practices in some kind of way? And how, you know, because I find literalism, fundamentalism, violence abhorrent.
My feeling is that religion, not just Islam, but religion today, yeah, serves what Zizek might call a supplemental function.
Okay.
That it is not... the religion of today is not the religion of old. That the religion of today can be replaced by a yoga workshop or a good diet plan. That it is a supplement to a certain kind of life, and or an encounter group or a chess club. That these things are all going to serve the same social function as religion today. Religion has a lot of rich history and depth to it that some of these other things don't. And you, obviously, it's better to join a philosophical club than it is to join a fan group around True Blood or something, you know, or True Detective, right? Yeah, But even, you know, you're going to find more depth and have a richer experience in one area than another. And religions offer a very deep supplement to the society, the kind of social life you have now. But nonetheless, both are the same kind of supplement. Radical religion, whether it's radical Islam or fundamentalist Christianity, you know, true fundamentalist Christianity, is aimed at getting back what has been lost, no longer being a supplement, but being the basis of social, of your social life. And that makes it political. And that makes it reactionary. It also makes it not the same as, but aligned with something like fascism, which is also, you know, trying to return to a traditional life. I don't think that, but because of religion's peculiar character, radical religious people can never fully think through what their aims are and are never going to be able to overturn the current social life. They don't think of what their project is in terms of this world. Right? So, yeah. So their aims are unconscious aims almost. But that's the difference to me between religion and radical religion. And I'm not really for either thing too much, but I'm far less critical of religion as a supplement.
Okay, what I find fascinating is that your what you just said works. I mean, it's a really consistent interpretation, and yet you've helped me formulate what I was trying to get out of myself. When I was a boy, and the Catholics will probably say the same thing to you, my mum told me, on my left shoulder is an angel who writes down everything. She said this literally when I was about 8, 9, writes down everything good that you do, and on your other shoulder is an angel that writes down everything bad that you do. And when you die, each of them will speak to God and say to God, this is what you did. And what I'm struck by when I listen to your interpretation about a supplement is that, and I look at my mother, for example, who's become more religious, but she doesn't fit the supplement model. She fits the earlier conversation we had about that third presence. And I, on a day-to-day life, on a day-to-day basis, because she prays 5 times a day, she reads the Quran almost constantly these days, she feels this presence. It's almost like a... it's not a spirit. It's not a mystical presence. It's not like she's just taken some LSD and she's got a constant, you know, mind-splitting experience that Aldous Huxley described in The Doors of Perception. It's not that type of presence. It is submerged. And perhaps it's slightly malevolent. Her day-to-day experience is this absence, presence, absence thing. And I think what radical Islam does is it fleshes out. It actually projects that. Because there's a profound yearning in that type of thing. If you constantly feel paranoid, and along came someone and they said to you, you had good reason to be paranoid because I was watching you. You know, it's like Zizek's chicken story about a chicken man who thinks he's a chicken and eats it and all that. But if someone came along and said to you, look, I know what you feel because you and I have been brought up in the same tradition. We both feel this presence. And I can tell you, I have a closer grasp of it. So you listen to me. I'll channel it through for you. If you can make it real, flesh it out. You can see this in death cults and Charles Manson type behavior as well. Whereas my mum would never follow somebody. She actually follows a Sufi school and she goes off to and she tries to follow the more spiritual stuff and admits how difficult it is. Absolutely difficult to reconcile this constant God in a very ordinary way is a constant presence and a pressure on, I would say, a very ordinary Muslim, not a radical one, not necessarily even fundamental. And I think what radical Islam does, maybe this complements your explanation of supplement, is it comes along and says, we'll flesh it out for you. It's like the totem. I'll become the totem. You can project all of your yearnings and your worries onto me and I'll handle them like a charismatic figure or someone who claims to have this privileged access. And then suddenly the situation changes dramatically. You just need to take someone slightly not very well thought out, not very well read, who has that same everyday... I wonder if Catholics feel it, but they have the Pope, and the Pope presents almost a constant light in the Catholic universe, I think. And then, and this current one seems to be, you know, saying some reasonably half reasonable things. But in Islam, you don't have a Pope figure. Islam banishes the priesthood, formally banishes them. It only allows scholars who can help you interpret the law and so on and so forth. So you look around and you try to find these figures, and they latch on to spiritual schools. I mean, I don't know if you know that in the States, one of the most popular poets, I am told, but this might be worth Googling, is Rumi. One of the, and I think, what? How is that popular? How is that possible? It strikes me that that's, it's around that. So the supplement version, complemented by this constant presence of something. You know, lapsed Catholics have said to me, when I've described this experience to them, they say, we feel the same thing, but we have the Pope. And he kind of, we comfort ourselves by saying, he's a decent guy out there and he'll guide me. But if you're a Muslim, you don't have a decent guy out there or a decent woman out there who's standing as that figurehead. You look at the last 30, 40 years, you have those ayatollahs in Iran throwing fatwas. Fatwas at, what was it, Salman Rushdie. I don't know if you remember, that's the Salman Rushdie story. I remember it vividly because it was the first time ever my father, who was very, very liberal, he's like a Church of England type religious person, started to curse at the phone when he's at the TV when the story came up in the news. And I turned to him and said, that is just ludicrous. You've not read the book. You don't know what's going on. So stop behaving like that. And he got very embarrassed and we kind of settled down. But it's not the case. I think this is where there is something about religion, and it's not unique to Islam. Judaism has it, I think. Catholicism has it. Unitarianism, I don't know if it does have it. I think it has. If Unitarianism is the one I understand, it's linked to American Transcendentalism, to Emerson, and the School of East Coast.
Yeah, you know, I was a Unitarian Universalist, which is, I don't know, I don't even know its full history, but it's a little bit different than this, than the Universalist Church, certainly, and different than just Unitarians. But okay, here's my thing. You haven't said anything to me about your mother's experience that makes me doubt my analysis of religion, liberal religion, basically, or non-radical religion as anything other than a supplement, because you can have an experience in many different contexts where you are getting a meaning for your life from a supplement. You know, Star Trek is certainly one of them, and I kind of sometimes kid about Star Trek being a religion. In fact, I have a book deal with Zero that happened under the previous regime, and I need to finish the book. And my original thought was I was going to write a book about Star Trek and Hegel and Marx, and I was going to call it Star Trek is the True Religion. But I decided that would be confusing.
I think I saw that on one of the podcasts.
So, but yeah. People can, you know, they whether or not they feel or would admit to feeling the eyes of Spock upon them or something, I think is questionable. but they will dress up in their day-to-day lives. There are people who make their living rooms look like the bridge of the Enterprise. They, you know, they learn languages. It takes discipline, and they have a real feeling of connection and support to the franchise.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. I think you're right about this. I need to think about more what it was. It's not that
you,
I want
to... What you really want to say, I think, is, look, there is a God, you know, and we can feel him. You know, I think that would be the argument that would be saying, no, you're wrong about it being a symptom, which is just to go ahead and make the theist claim.
I would like to say it, but I know that saying it in that way would falsify something very precious to me. After spending all this time trying to think about my religious roots, looking at the conflicts in the world, looking at education, I don't want to enter a partisan territory of someone saying, no, I disagree with you, because I think that it's this... It's not that there is a God, but there we have to dethrone part of the kind of over-speculation of science and leave a space for nothing to exist, but not nothing in the negation sense, but nothing in the absence sense, because there is something that's intrinsically, we need to be, human beings, I think, need to be, maybe I'm going back to the Enlightenment, right? Going back to that little Kant essay where he says, have the courage to, and the immaturity, of always relying on authority. I don't want a God to come back in any form of the one I recognize as a child. I'm happy to live with this paranoid sense that there is something that I can't articulate. And at moments of epiphany and at moments of other biochemical intervention, if I can put it discreetly like that, you can sense that sense more. You can enter ecstatic religious practices and go off to Mexico and all the rest of it. I think there's a lot of truth and integrity to some of those experiences. And so I don't want the universe to belong to a being that created this world and then sits there in judgment of it, because I think that corrupts our nature, fundamentally corrupts it. But I think what my point is that Islam is caught, its enlightenment was back in the 12th century, and it's now caught, I think, in a downward spiral. It needs to find something which will refresh its own kind of thing. It needs to counter this. Radical Islam is like the cancerous ultra-fascist extreme. And I think any kind of alignment with it, my biggest problem is that the right-wing press all over the world is aligning itself with it because it loves the spectacle of the violence and the cruelty of it. And, Fox News was the only place that played some of these horrible beheadings. And I can happily say I've never watched them because I thought, what purpose would it serve?